The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Hello, and welcome to the American College of Osteopathic Internists annual convention and scientific sessions. This year's meeting was held in conjunction with the annual clinical assembly of the American College of Osteopathic Surgeons. The meeting was held October 11th through 15th, 2017, and featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of interest to the practicing physician. The meeting was held at the Gaylord National Resort and Convention Center in National Harbor, Maryland. The program chair is Dr. Annette Karen, and the theme for this year's presentations is Goldilocks Medicine, Not Too Little, Not Too Much. Tests I Wish You'd Never Ordered is presented by Dr. Gerald Blackburn, Dr. Michael James, Dr. William Pepo, and Dr. Steven Sokowski. Dr. Blackburn serves as moderator for this session.
Well, thanks for having the stamina to be here at this time of day. I don't think I ever stayed for a lecture this late in my life. So, there's one good thing about this topic, or range of topics, is I never run out of material. So I happened to come across this slide on my homepage for the computer, which reminded me of the lecture, The Law of Unintended Consequences. So maybe we could rename this The Law of Unintended Medical Consequences. And I happened to like the outcome here because the gentleman who was out trophy hunting shot at the elephant, and it fell on him and crushed him. And so the point is that what we do has consequences, and they're not always what we would like. So this is our more or less annual 10th or 12th version of Test I Wish You'd Never Ordered. I have no conflicts to disclose. And I came across this, which I think really applies to what we're going to talk about today. And this is sort of a spin-off of the old story, when I was a resident, and everyone groans when you hear that. But when I was a resident, the contest between all our medical residents was who could write the most orders on admission. And if you're old enough, that's how it was. And if you could write more orders than the guy next to you, somehow that made you a better resident. But I had no clue of what that really led up to. So the definition of a well person might be someone who's not been completely worked up, or maybe someone who did not have me writing the orders on admission. Way back in 1971, this author, or cartoonist, put this out talking about the environment, but it could also be talking about us today and what kind of medical environment we are living in, or it could be talking about electronic medical records, my God. But the point of this is that medical errors occur, and they have dire consequences for lots of people. The Institute of Medicine published this a few years ago, and basically said, most people, and that includes you, not just your patients, most people will experience at least one diagnostic error in their lifetime, sometimes with devastating consequences. We've had multiple people contribute to this program, many of who have their own unique experiences that they could go on forever about. And today we have three panelists who have what in common? Well, they all graduated from CCOM way back in 1969. What else do they have in common? Yes, they're really old. But what else do they have in common? They're really smart, and they're really experienced. And they have all come back and contributed to our profession. They taught me much. If I got it wrong, I apologize, but I'm very grateful for what they contributed to my education. And with that, I will ask Dr. Sokowski to start the program. But let me remind you that when I find when I talk to house staff, not to mention attendings and you folks, and I talk about patients, you get that deer in the headlights look much of the time. But when you think it also applies to you, maybe not so much. So let me remind you, someday, maybe tomorrow, maybe tonight, you will be a patient. And I've also come to appreciate that you won't get a warning most of the time. Today you're fine, tomorrow you're not. So let's hope to God that the patients or that the physicians that take care of you absolutely provide you with the best care possible. And that's what today is all about. Steve?
Red means forward. I mean, green or forward. I'm going to start out with a reality check, and that is that CMS Medicare requires that every hospital report central line-associated bloodstream infections. The method for reporting those is a surveillance method. It may not agree with what we think clinically is a central line infection, but is reportable. Through some magic mathematics, CMS has decided that if you don't meet their standards, and we don't know what their standards are, that you will lose between 1% and 3% of your Medicare billing in a year. In a place like our hospital, over 700 beds, 95% occupancy, you're talking about millions of dollars. So why am I all
green?
Okay. So why am I all riled up about this? Okay. Let's start out with a case history here. A nurse, doctor, your ICU patient has a fever of 38.8 degrees centigrade. What do you want me to order? And the doctor's source says, draw two blood cultures from the central line now. And for a fever greater than 38.5, start gadamycin. And what are the indications for blood cultures? Well, clinical features of sepsis, which we'll all agree is systemic inflammatory response syndrome, suspicion of endocarditis, fever of unknown origin, leukocytosis oftentimes requires blood cultures, and systemic and localized infections. So what happened in this case, in the next 24 hours, three different sets of blood cultures are drawn, and what's wrong with this picture? You left the nurse a order saying 38.5, draw some more blood cultures. So I've seen up as many as eight different sets of blood cultures drawn in 24 hours. What's wrong with that? When you draw blood cultures, the volume is the most important variable, and you need to get 20 to 30 ml per culture set. Children may have graduated volumes. The ideal number of sets, which is an anaerobic and an aerobic bottle, is somewhere between 2 and 4. And in acute sepsis, what you do is you draw two blood cultures before you do anything else, and then move on from there. Blood cultures should be drawn before the antibiotics are started. And catheter-drawn blood cultures have a higher contamination rate. Do not submit catheter tips for culture without an accompanying blood culture. We have some people who, every time they remove a catheter, send a tip down for culture. Not a good idea. And you never refrigerate these prior to incubation. Now, what's our statistics? If you drew one blood culture and grew a significant pathogen, that would be likely to happen 73 to 80%. If you drew the second blood culture, it would be 80 to 89%, and a third blood culture, 95 to 98. With some of the newer systems for analyzing and growing blood cultures, two blood cultures are almost as good as a third one. But one blood culture is rarely advisable because you have to interpret that, and that's difficult to do. Contamination is common in drawing blood cultures, 0.6 to 6%. And when you get a positive blood culture, it becomes pretty costly. And in order to draw a blood culture, you have to be obsessive about skin preparation prior to each venipuncture or central line blood draw. False blood cultures, you've all seen this. Blood culture grows gram-positive cocci in pairs and chains, or gram-positive cocci in clusters. You're going to start antibiotics in many of these circumstances. Other labs are drawn at that time. There's a 20% increase in lab charges, 39% increase in antibiotic charges. And half of the patients with positive blood cultures were treated with antibiotics, oftentimes vancomycin, at a cost of $1,000 per patient at a minimum. So the consensus guidelines and experts panel recommend peripheral venipuncture as a preferred method. It's less likely to be contaminated than drawing from a central line. Chlorhexidine should be used rather than polidone iodine for disinfection. And there should be a 30-second dwell time for disinfection. How many times did you order those two blood cultures and somebody from the lab drew a syringe worth of blood and inoculated two sets rather than sticking the patient twice? It happens more than you'd like it to happen. If you're talking about colonization of central venous catheters, 15 to 25% of them are colonized. The sensitivity of a catheter draw is 89% versus 78% from the peripheral that it's going to grow something. But the reality is that it's for real with a positive predictive value of 63% for the cath versus 73% for the percutaneous. You might want to consider drawing one from a catheter and one from the peripheral vein. When two of two blood cultures are positive with the same organism, the predictive value of both from a vein is 98%. It's 96%. One came from a vein, one from the catheter. But guess what? It's only 50% if both of them are drawn from a catheter. So you think you're doing your patient a favor and not sticking them, you're not doing them a favor, you're not doing yourself a favor. So again, draw them from two sites. And one of the interesting things about endocarditis, people talk about drawing blood cultures after a patient has shaking chills or a fever. In endocarditis, the blood cultures are positive 24/7. It's a continuous bacteremia. So no matter when you draw them, they're gonna be positive. Okay. After you draw on your blood cultures, you don't need to draw another set for 48 hours. How many of you have had the chickening out point where 3 hours later, the nurse calls you, what was 38 is now 39, and you say, draw a couple more blood cultures. That doesn't do anybody any good. We usually want to wait until 48 hours before we might consider drawing further blood cultures if the patient has not had a clinical response. The central line-associated bloodstream infection that we have to report to CMS is a diagnosis by exclusion. There's no microbiologic gold standard for the diagnosis, no firm conclusions for relative merits of diagnostic techniques. The first is documentation of bacteremia, and catheter tip culture alone, doing a culture of that is not helpful. Sometimes you have a patient who may have a central line in, the surgeon doesn't want to pull that central line. They don't want to get that porticath out of there. How are you going to prove to the surgeon that, in fact, that patient probably has a real central line infection? Because 50% of the time, they look normal. Okay? And one way you can do that is to do quantitative blood cultures. And if you have five times more organisms growing from the porticath than you do it from the peripheral vein, that's good evidence. And also a false positive blood culture, especially with coagulase negative staph, it oftentimes won't show up in 24 to 48 hours after it's been drawn. It'll be longer than that. You want to discourage blood culture draws in patients with low risk. Catheter site disinfection may be less effective than doing percutaneous sites. Just to give an example, this is an outbreak that we dealt with a number of years ago. I got a call that a number of patients who were at an infusion center were growing Klebsia oxytosa or Enterobacter cloacae. They were admitted to three different hospitals, but the common denominator is that they were all treated at the same infusion center. This was published. There were 112 cultures drawn. We found that some of these patients were exposed to a flush at the line flush at the center from 2.9 to 3.3, and some of them even earlier than that from 2.17. I'm sorry, even later than that from 2.17 to 3.3. and 27 confirmed cases of positive blood cultures with either Klebsiella, Enterobacter, or 5 infected with both organisms. Okay. They were all at the same chemotherapy center. 18 presented them with symptoms, and 9 were identified by blood culture surveillance. And all cases received a saline flush during the period from 2/17 to 3/3. We sampled everything. This became a major medical legal issue, as you might imagine. There were a million things wrong with this center, including that the infusion center was next door to the GI center, and they both used the same bathroom. And we eventually found that the saline flushes were most likely contaminated. What was happening is that the nurses in the morning would draw the saline into syringes that were unmarked, put into a basket, a wicker basket, and used throughout the day to flush catheters. They would change the saline bag every day, put in a new fresh bag, but guess what? They never changed the infusion set. They used the same one for days because they were told they were using too many infusion sets. Okay. So this is the example I want to lead you to, that there were a number of these patients. If you look at the bottom group of patients with the yellow markers on them, these were patients who were identified by a blood culture surveillance who were asymptomatic. It shows once again that central lines can be easily colonized. This is a great example of this, with very virulent pathogens, and the patients are asymptomatic. But guess what happens to these patients if they get chemotherapy and become neutropenic? You are in deep trouble, and you would not have known it beforehand. Just to give you an idea, density incidence of central lines, if you're using a central venous catheter, 2.7 over every 1,000 catheter days. PICC lines are 2.1 over 1,000 catheter days. Tunnel catheters are 1.6 over 1,000 catheter days. Peripheral venous catheters are 0.5 over 1,000 catheter days. And implantable ports systems are 0.1 over every 1,000 catheter days. However, look at what happens if you use internal jugular access. Chances are 1 to 3.3 more likely that you'll get an infection there. Subclavian access seems to be safer, but look at the femoral access, 3.3 to 4.8. Do not use the femoral vein. It's the bottom line. It's really going to cause problems. So I hope I clarified things for you. What was the stupid thing that we all thought about, just draw the blood cultures, is actually quite relevant and quite important, not just because of reporting to government agencies, but also to the care of the patient and overutilization of antibiotics. Thank you.
All right, well, I want to thank Jerry for inviting me and speak in front of the ACY. Basically, I'm going to talk about a selective area, it's the use of oxygen in COPD patients. Now, when I was taking care of patients in a hospital and I had interns and residents, there was one particular resident would always come up to me and say, I know you say hypoxemia kills. And I said, yes, that's true. When they come in acutely, we need to treat respiratory patients with oxygen. The question now becomes, should they be discharged on home oxygen, and when they come to see in your office, should you continue them on oxygen? And that's basically what I want to go over. So we have this guy here. Now, if this guy wasn't around, I'm not sure we'd need oxygen. Our oxygen use would be minimal because most of the patients on oxygen right now are patients with COPD. So today I want to go over some objectives. I want to review a few office patients. I want to discuss the only indications there are for true oxygen therapy in COPD patients, and how we identify them, and what we do when they walk around and they have oxygen desaturation. Discuss the prognosis of COPD with long-term oxygen therapy, and what do we do with intermittent or continuous oxygen? And then we'll try to come up with some conclusions. So I had two recent patients, and you know, last year when Jerry said, let's get this talk together, I wasn't sure, oh man, I don't know what I'm gonna talk about. D-dimers, nobody wants to talk about D-dimers, we're not even sure where that falls in. And I started seeing these patients in my office on this oxygen. I said, these patients need oxygen. I said, I don't know. But I had two recent patients who I thought were somewhat illustrative. One was an 81-year-old female referred to the office because her oxygen needed to be recertified. She recently moved from Arizona, from New York. A lot of people moving out there. That's where I am now. She had a history. It was kind of vague getting her history, but her son was there. But supposedly she had COPD bronchiectasis and had been on nasal oxygen for 5 years. She was initially placed, what I could gather, 5 years ago during a hospitalization for aspiration pneumonia. And her son said she uses her oxygen most of the time, but frequently she takes it off. She's on daily ICS LABA and LAMA inhaled therapy and sporadic albuterol use. Her resting oxygen, pulse oximetry was 96% on 2 liters in August. So I decided to take her off oxygen. I said, let's take her off oxygen and assess her during a 6-minute walk. So here's her 6-minute walk test. This is on room air. And you can see that the first one at rest, she was 95%. She did go down a little bit to 89% at 6 minutes. She varied a little bit and immediately came up to 94 and 93%. Question is, what do you do with her oxygen? Well, I looked at her office notes that I was able to get from 2014. And interestingly, the office notes from New York were that she was on 3 liters, she was 97%. In an ambulation on room air, she started off at 94% and did not drop. And it was interesting, the physician stated in records, and we all get into this trap. I'm not, you know, this is something we all do. So I don't think that she needs supplemental O2 at this point, but she continues to use it. And she did. So what do you do about her oxygen now that you're seeing her? We have to discontinue it. Can't be recertified. I mean, and here's, we were talking earlier this morning when I was listening to a talk about the cost of how we're just ordering things and cost of medicine. We've been paying for her oxygen for 5 years. So I had a second patient, a 69-year-old male with a history of severe COPD, multiple hospitalizations for COPD exacerbation. He was on a ventilator for his COPD. He was discharged home on supplemental oxygen. Discharge on oxygen, take it all the time. But he didn't take it all the time. He only used it sporadically. He's able to do his ADLs okay. He has chronic cough and sputum. And he was on the usual therapy, ICS, LABA, LAMA, albuterol. So I saw him a few times. And every time I did a pulse oximetry reading on ambient air, room air, it varied 92, 93, 89, and 96. 89 was after another hospitalization. So he still has home O2. What should happen with his O2? He was discharged from the hospital on O2. Well, it won't be certified for continued use. Try to stop his O2. See if you can take it away from him. There is only about one or two ways you can have someone get rid of their oxygen at home when they're not using it, because they all want it. They don't all want it. So here's a tip off. Now, she actually works in our office, so she's very happy right now. But the tip off that supplemental oxygen may not be needed is that her pulse ox on nasal oxygen is 93%. Take her off it. Her pulse ox is 94% at rest on room air. Why does she have O2? Is she using it? Who's paying for it? And should her oxygen be discontinued? Yes, it has to be. And she's happy because we're going to discontinue her oxygen. But like I say, she doesn't have COPD. She just works in our office. So she doesn't mind I put her picture, although she didn't like it that much, actually. So I had a student that works with me. I work at Midwestern in Arizona. Had him come to the office. I only worked there 1 day a week, seeing a few patients, and the rest of the time at Midwestern. So I had him come in and say, I want you to look at all the patients. We can get all our patients on COPD for the last year, and we'll see who's on oxygen, who isn't on oxygen. Well, you can read this over, and I'll just summarize it. I hate to say it, it's somewhat chaos. It's what we all do. So 35 were not on home oxygen, 66 on home oxygen, 66 were on oxygen. Of those, 29, 88% on room air at rest, did not meet the criteria. And others had some reasons for oxygen. 8 had nocturnal oxygen desaturation, 7 had exercise, and 14 out of those 30, there was no reason why they were on oxygen. Now there's 7 of us that work in the office. I'm only there 1 day a week, so it's all of us put together. Now we had some on room air that there were 37 out of 66 19 met the standard criteria, and the remaining patients who were on HOMO2, there was no reason for that. So we did have some patients that were walked. They had COPD, we're gonna walk you to see if you need oxygen. I don't think that's a good idea, because what are you gonna do with it? 41 had exertional desaturation, went from 93, 94, went down to 89, but not below 80, 89. Of those six that continued oxygen therapy, only two noted symptomatic improvement. But what does that really mean? Does that mean that they're gonna live longer, mortality benefit? 22 had decreased less than 88, and seven initiated on oxygen had some symptomatic improvement. So 9 out of 68 that walked and desatted noted symptomatic improvement with the use of oxygen. Did they need it? Well, let's see. So many of the patients in our office didn't meet the Medicare guidelines, which we're going to review. Some are given supplemental O2 for various reasons, discharged in an acute situation, say, take this oxygen, you got to get out of the hospital early. That's why we're going to give you the oxygen. But nobody tells them that it needs to be reevaluated to be recertified. And they have it. They have it for a year until the oxygen company comes by and says, recertify that oxygen. So, and a lot of patients, I hate to say this, in our office, and we have there seven of us, are on home oxygen, and it's not really clear. And once patients have home oxygen, it's difficult to discontinue it. They don't want to give it up. They feel it is a safety net for them. And the only time they'll give it up is when you say, if you want to continue it, you're going to have to pay for it because Medicare is no longer going to pay for it. And then they gladly give it up. They're going to say, take it, you know. So this guy here, who's this guy? Joseph Priestley. Well, he's a pretty interesting guy. He wrote this in, I think it was 1774, 1772. He wrote about deflagellated air oxygen. The candle burned brighter, the mouse lived longer, and we don't have it in there, but he said he thinks there's a salutary effect on lungs. All right, that was 1774. All right, we'll come back to that in a minute. So in the United States, there's all these people with COPD. John West, famous physiologist, wrote in New England Journal recently, it's the second leading cause of death. It's really rated the third, second, I don't know, it could be right now. And smoking cessation, long-term oxygen therapy, if indicated, are the only treatments that reduce mortality in COPD. And here you go, $2 billion per year. So we need to make sure that that what we're giving is something that is gonna be of benefit for the patient. So we know that long-term oxygen therapy, it reduces pulmonary hypoxemic vasoconstriction, reduces pulmonary hypertension, corpus increase, and so it will reduce these things and also reduce polycythemia or secondary to hypoxemic states. And you notice here, I want you to look at, it says 18 hours per day, because the original study wasn't 18 hours, which we're gonna go to right now. Oh, another reason to ensure patients meet the criteria before prescribing, because they may get burns, they may fall, they may have respiratory depression. That's mainly in the hospital if you're not monitoring carefully. You know, I've had very few problems with patients on oxygen, though. And if you look at the bottom, it says there's no evidence, currently no evidence of long-term oxygen at therapeutic levels has any adverse effects. I do have four memorable situations. That's all in over, I don't want to say, he already told you how long we've been doing this for, so I won't repeat it. But I had one guy when I was in Michigan. He had his oxygen, he had a pickup truck, but he forgot to turn it on. So he reached down. I can still see his wife telling me that. Reached down to turn it on, and what do you think happened? Off the road, into a tree, ICU, passed away, didn't make it. I had one out in Arizona recently, not too long ago, about a year ago. Needed oxygen. Oxygen company went to the house. He was a hoarder. Said, we're not dropping this oxygen off, and took it back home, or took it back, because they were afraid it would be combustible. And then, of course, the anxiety. I always felt that somebody's gonna trip over it and break a hip or something like that. Hasn't happened. And the other one is, I can still see this guy. He came into my office when I was in Michigan. He had all these burns on his lips and his nasal oxygen. I said, what happened? He just went like this. He said, I was smoking, and my lips caught on fire, and I patted them out. So that does happen. Yeah. And so maybe he needed someone like this. You know, don't smoke with your oxygen tank. I don't know. But to be honest, I can still see him today. All right. So there were two studies in the 1980s, and I hate to say it. I was at that American Thoracic Society meeting when they went over oxygen, continuous oxygen, and actually contributed a couple of cases from a physician from Henry Ford, Paul Qualley, wanted to know if I had any cases. I said, sure, I've got some cases. And what they did is they did continuous oxygen therapy, actually the nocturnal oxygen treatment therapy versus the usual nocturnal oxygen therapy. It's a little confusing terminology. Take it for 12 hours or sleep with it or use it for 24 hours. And there was no question, and this study was duplicated by the MRC Medical Research Council, that those patients that used the oxygen prescribed for 24 hours, if they needed it, live longer. Now, remember I said before, it said 18 hours? Actually, I was at the study, and they put up 18 hours because when they asked everyone, did you use it for 24 hours? The average was only actually 18 hours. So that's how, if you read about the 18 hours, that's how it came about. So, oh, we got to go back, Jerry. There we go. So the current indication for long-term oxygen therapy is severe hypoxemia at rest, and that should be PaO2 of 55 or less, 55 or less, 88% or less on room air. Or if they have core pulmonality, the other criteria will work, as you can see. And this just shows that the nocturnal oxygen therapy trial, which is the continuous 18 hours or greater, it was never 20, no one, I mean, most people should do it, take it 24 hours if they need oxygen, but the average is 18. They live longer, and that's all this graph shows. If you use it more, you live longer if it's indicated. Now, so Priestley discovered probably oxygen in 1774. Lavoisier called it oxygen later on. Okay, 1774, 1980, that's like 206 years later. We had the first study that said oxygen is good for you if your PO2 is low or you're desatting. But they never studied the effects on exercise. And nocturnal for COPD was never studied in quality of life. It took this study in 2016 in the New England Journal that showed, they did a large multi-center study of over 738 patients. And what they found is that it's kind of crazy. It says moderate resting desaturation. That means they use 89 as the desaturation. We always considered it, if you're desatting, you're in the 80s. But, if you're 95 and you go to 89, consider that desaturation. And they walk the patients. And here you can read the data, and it says they followed all these patients, and even some that were below 86% after walking. And what did they find? No significant difference in mortality, time to first hospitalization, exercise tolerance, and quality of well-being. So patients without oxygen, if their resting saturation was greater, 89% or greater, if they walked and desatted below that, there was no difference in their mortality or any of these other things than if they didn't desat. And this is kind of busy. That just gives you the data. Now, so what does that tell us, though? Well, it might predict future need for oxygen. So if someone has oxygen desaturation on ambulation, they really don't meet the Medicare guidelines, but this study indicated that continue to monitor them because they may need to be on continuous oxygen. In a five-year follow-up, there was a significant number that needed continuous oxygen. So what was the conclusion? Early and severe exercise desaturation are poor prognostic factors in COPD and suggest disease progression and may predict the future need for long-term oxygen therapy. That means 24 hours. But no study at this time correlates the use of oxygen in patients with exercise desaturation less than 80% with reduced mortality rate. So I think that's the key point here. So you can see that there. This is kind of a summary. Long-term oxygen therapy, no benefit with oxygen in patients with stable COPD if they drop down below 89. So here's the problem. Dyspnea, let's face it, though. The COPD patient has, for most intents and purposes, has created this disease on their own. Smoking is the number one. There are other things, biomass, air pollution, toxic inhalations, and that sort of thing. But it's mainly the cigarettes. So when you think about someone who's smoking, do they have the motivation to exercise and to be active? Well, they might later on. But dyspnea still discourages them from doing things. Well, I can't do this activity because I'm short of breath. and they're deconditioned. And when they get deconditioned, they exercise less. I didn't put this study in there, but there was a study on using oxygen and going to pulmonary rehab and showed that exercise tolerance was improved, even though they didn't need it when they were walking around doing normal ADLs. So the role of oxygen can be used in pulmonary rehab if they DSAT and they have pulmonary rehab. The question is, can you get the patients to motivated to walk when they feel they're short of breath? That is a little bit of a tough problem. So what are some of indications for oxygen use, long-term oxygen therapy? Well, because it's so costly, we should really base our use of oxygen on, is it going to be a mortality benefit and improvement in quality of life? I mean, that's really what we need to do, treat the patient, and you have to treat the number in this case. All patients meeting the Medicare standard criteria should be placed on oxygen. All others really needs to be discontinued. We need to control some of these costs. And patients should be monitored, however, for future continued use of oxygen. Exercise desaturation below 89 is an indication for continued monitoring, but not a sole indication to start oxygen therapy. And should be reevaluated. Patients should be reevaluated in the future. Now, there was another slide in here that first patient that was sent to me was sent to me by the OMM Family Medicine Clinic at Midwestern, and actually talked to the physician who sent me the patient, who's an OMM specialist. He's excellent, and he is actually going to treat the patient with OMM techniques in an attempt to help her improve her dyspneic feelings. So I think there may be a role here. I think there is definitely a role, actually, for the use of OMM in patients who have some oxygen desaturation but don't meet the standard Medicare criteria for continuous oxygen. And this is it. This is our most portable tank. Unfortunately, it only lasts 3 minutes. Maybe this guy doesn't need oxygen. So I think my only point is, when they come in your office with oxygen, what I normally do now routinely, and we're going to set up a little protocol in the office, I'm only there one day a week, is anyone that comes in on a nasal oxygen, and their pulse oximetry is in the 90s, but above 93 or greater, even maybe 92, we're going to take them off their oxygen for 15 minutes and reassess them. So I think that this is what we need to do, and I think we need to, before we order anyone to have oxygen, either being discharged from the hospital or in the office, I think it's critical to assess whether they really need it. Thank you very much.
A lot of references there, Billy. So, last speaker on the first day, better than the last speaker on the last day. So, like Butch Cassidy said to Sundance, who are those guys? And here's who those guys are. This was Return of the Dinosaurs. This was our graduation pictures in 1969. And I guess you can look up here and see if there's a lot of wear on those tires, or see if you folks will still be practicing medicine 50 years later. It was a time when we went to the Chicago College of Osteopathy, not the Chicago College of Osteopathic Medicine, the Chicago College of Osteopathy. We went into this brick building. There were three floors. You walked up a flight of stairs. The sophomores are on the left. The freshmen are on the right. The dean was right next to you. In the basement was the anatomy lab with Chicky Strawn, who is an excellent anatomist. Upstairs were the biochem lab and the microbiology lab. The University of Chicago was about 5 blocks away, and most of us would spend Saturdays making rounds at the University of Chicago. So we got our basic science here. We were seeing patients when we were freshmen down the road to the Chicago Osteopathic Hospital. The dean at the time, in Illinois, we did not have full practice rights at DOs, so the dean went back to Northwestern, got an MD degree, and was signing most of the prescriptions at the time. So at the time, there were five colleges of osteopathic medicine. Our philosophy was see one, do one, teach one. We had a very bright man who was the chairman of medicine, and he told us to go out and get good training and come back and teach. Steve went to Press St. Luke's, came back and taught, is still teaching today. I did my residency in Chicago. I did my fellowship at the University of Michigan. Still teaching today, still practicing medicine at my age. Bill went and took pulmonary. He's now chairman of medicine at the college in Arizona and still teaching. So all of you have an obligation to come back and teach our students. And I think it's an honor to be an osteopathic physician. And all the back, when we started school, I'm not sure we wanted to be DOs. But I'll tell you right now, we're very happy to be DOs. And I have two sons that are DOs. And one went to Chicago College of Osteopathic Medicine, now Midwestern University. And my other son went to MSU-CLM. Okay, so now Steve had this pet bird when we were graduated. He loved this bird. And this bird lasted for all these years, but it dropped dead about 5 weeks ago. Steve, very academic, took the bird to the veterinarian, and the veterinarian looked at this bird and said, "Steve, this bird's dead." Steve didn't believe him. So he said, "You know, I'm a scientist. I need some more information." So the vet said, "Okay." He brings out this Labrador retriever. The lab looks at the bird, shakes his head. He's dead. Steve says, no, come on. We need more information. The vet goes and gets his cat. Cat comes in, looks at the bird, shakes his head, dead. Okay, so Steve finally says, "Okay, I believe you. Go out and pay your bill." Bill was $540. And the vet said, $40 for me, but because of the lab test and the CAT scan, it's $500. Okay. So we get paid for doing tests. And there's nothing wrong with tests, it's just how they're used. So I was, before echocardiography, our big thing at the University of Michigan where I trained was phonocardiography. So who does phonocardiography anymore? Who actually listens to hearts anymore? Some of my younger colleagues feel that the stethoscope is a tool for the museum and that imaging is the way to go. But I'd have to say that with my training, that give me a stethoscope and a patient, I'll take the history and do my own physical examination, and the cost of medicine will be significantly reduced. So when Bill and I were rotating through DOH, we were trying to decide, what are we going to do when we go out? Are we going to be pulmonologists, cardiologists? And Bill pointed out that cardiology has lots of pop stands. I said, "Bill, what are you talking about, a pop stand?" He says, "Those are the places where you make a lot of money, because we do a lot of procedures on patients." So this delicious menu presents the physician with the pen, and as Jerry said, and by the way, Jerry was a freshman student in 1969 when Steve and I came back to teach at the Chicago College. He was one of those bright-eyed students that we couldn't get rid of, and he was always following us around, and we gave back to what we could do for him. So anyway, ordering a lot of tests, now you have the mouse because everything is on an EMR. There are two kinds of physicians, I say. Those that order a bunch of tests and try to fit the patient into the test, the spaghetti approach. And then the type of physician that we all are, and hopefully are, that we evaluate the patient, decide what test is necessary, and confirm our diagnosis. So when all this fails, let's go examine the patient. The pop stands of cardiology, EKG, lab test, take this with a grain of salt, but I think troponin is one of the most worthless abuse tests in cardiology. Not because it's a bad test, it's because when someone shows up with chest pain, the first thing we do is order a troponin. Troponin is positive, call for a cardiologist, call for the cath lab, it's got to be an acute myocardial infarction. BNP is another one of those tests. Just 2 days ago, I was seeing a physician who I'm taking care of for atrial fib, normal left ventricular function, bicycles 35 miles, still works full time, went to see his primary care physician, ordered a BNP on him, for whatever reason, I don't know. The BNP was 400. He calls him up and said, I can't get life insurance, my BNP is too high. It was actually a pro BNP, and the normal is less than 440 on a pro BNP. But the question is, why would you order a healthy, on a healthy individual, a test like a BNP, which I didn't know. So I assured him, and I think we'll be okay, but now he's gonna get a real BNP because it wasn't a pro BNP, so now we're chasing tests. What about echocardiography? Echocardiography is a great test for looking at left ventricular function. It's probably one of the better tests. We're looking at ejection fraction. How about outpatient monitoring? Well, I'm not rounding in our main hospital anymore. I'm not doing intervention. I'm not doing a lot of things. So I've become the palpitation experts of the world. And so when I see patients, we have all these options of monitoring their heart. We've got a 24-hour Holter. We have a 48 Holter. We have a 30-day telemetry. Now we have implantable devices that you can monitor patients' heart for 2 years for a slight cost of $30,000. So what are we looking for when we're looking for palpitations? PACs, PVCs, maybe some short bursts of atrial fibrillation, which is treatable. Ventricular tachycardia in patients with normal LV function, you're not going to treat it anyway. So if you have a bad ventricle, if you have a bad egg and you have ventricular fibrillation, ventricular tachycardia, we're going to treat the underlying cause and you're probably going to get an ICD. So just think of the amount of money that we're spending on chasing palpitations when most of them are benign. If you've got normal left ventricular function, we're not going to treat them anyway because you can't treat PACs and PVCs. And if it's the primary problem rather than the problem with the myocardium. Stress tests, we have every possible kind of stress test, the garden variety, the stress echo, the nuclear, we'll get into which one you like to use. Imaging, the CT scan. 5 years ago, our group got into it, and I'm with a group of 26 cardiologists in Lansing, Michigan. We're part of the College of Osteopathic Medicine teaching. But we got this idea that we need a 64-slice CT scan. We scanned all our physicians, we scanned our physicians' wives, we scanned our referring physicians, the referring physicians' wives, and we found a lot of incidental omas. And we put stents in people that probably didn't need to have stents. We identified some left main disease, but on the amount of radiation that we caused by doing CTs on everybody, I'm not sure it was worth it. So. There's a couple of books that I read before giving this talk, and they were read by Gilbert Welsh. I don't know if you've ever read them, but one of them is Overdiagnosis, Making People Sick in the Pursuit of Health, and the other one is Less Medicine, More Health. And one of the things that he points out is if you were looking at lakes, and you were looking at lakes in Utah, and you had a telescope, and it was 1x, you would see the Great Salt Lake. You increase that to 5x, and you see 4 or 5 lakes around it. And then you increase that to 100x, and you see puddles that look like lakes. So part of the philosophy is, when we see these tests, when you see an echo that says mild mitral regurg, is that a puddle, is it a lake, or is it a big lake? So philosophically, we want to look at big things and not little things, because we're making these puddles, and we're making people sick by looking at puddles and doing test after test after test. And so I think it's up to us and you folks to decide what's a lake, what's the big lake, and what's a puddle that doesn't need to be get people excited. Like this physician friend of mine 2 days ago, who was a very good physician, a family doctor, who is now did a test on himself that he was very worried about. He had heart failure because his BNP was 400. This seems like the same thing with, and as Gilbert points out, mammography, PSAs, and all these things we've done to create, as he says, more disease. And the ultimate test is cardiac catheterization. I'm a cath jockey, an ex-cath jockey, so I've always believed that non-invasive is non-diagnostic. So if I really, in the past, wanted to find out if somebody had a heart problem, I probably just went to the cath lab. Okay, here's a case. I think you probably can read it, but I can summarize it for you. The patient is a 78-year-old Caucasian female who is coming in for cardiac clearance for cataract surgery. Now, the first thing is, there's no such thing as cardiac clearance. I used to, my anesthesia friends would ask for cardiac clearance, so I go in the OR in the morning and say, "Up, room one, you're cleared. Room two, up, stop surgery, you're not cleared. Room three, you're cleared." I say, "Guys, we don't clear anybody for surgery. We evaluate the risk of surgery and then make sure they're in the best possible condition for surgery." And most of the stuff we're doing for that is the anticoagulation management and the antiplatelet management, which was really well done earlier today. So we evaluate the risk of surgery, such as, say, the risk of a hip replacement in a patient with coronary disease and a bad LV is 2% mortality, and I still use the Goldman criteria, and a 5% morbidity. You tell the patient your risk of, and I can't change your risk, we'll do the best we can for you, but here's statistically what your risk is. It's 92% success rate, 5% morbidity, 2% mortality. And then the anesthesiologists are happy, the surgeon's happy, the patient understands what the risk is, and then we make sure they're in the best possible condition for surgery. This particular patient, for some reason, had a cardiolite stress test ordered on him. The cardiolite stress test indicated an area of ischemia in the anterior wall. The patient had a previous myocardial infarction, was well treated on medical management, beta blockers, ACE inhibitors, statins, aspirin, swam three times a week, absolutely no symptoms, but for some reason, the interventionalist decided to proceed and do a cardiac catheterization. During the catheterization, a high-grade lesion, a 70% lesion was noted in the left anterior descending, was calcified. Patient, the interventionalist decided to intervene, perfed the vessel, developed pericardial effusion, couldn't seal it, tried to drain it, was not possible to drain. Patient ended up in the OR, put on a vent, developed renal failure, was in the hospital for 2 weeks, and never had cataract surgery. This is a real case in our practice. So what's wrong with this picture? First of all, there's no need for routine preoperative testing for cataract surgery. In fact, there's a movement on now that you do not need a preoperative EKG for any procedure. And the thought was that a preoperative EKG gives you a baseline in case something happens during surgery. So in my research giving this talk, there's a move to don't do preoperative electrocardiograms, okay? Number two, here's the statistics on this. 20,000 patients were randomly assigned to pre-op testing and no testing. Pre-op testing was an electrocardiogram, a CBC, a BMP, a history and a physical. Overall complication rate was the same, 3% complication rate with cataract surgery. What were the complications? Hypertension, which can easily be taken care of, and bradycardia, which is basically asymptomatic. Occasional patient developed atrial fib, and in that age group, you would expect that. So no pre-op testing is indicated for cataract surgery, probably not for endoscopy, probably not for any type of carpal tunnel surgery, any kind of skin surgery, any type of thing. You really don't need pre-op testing. So the patient was asymptomatic, on appropriate medical therapy, therefore cardiac catheterization was not indicated. More importantly, why was intervention done on a patient who could swim three times a week on appropriate medical therapy? So the cardiolite stress test should have never been ordered. The patient should have been cleared for cataract surgery and gone on with it. The interventionalist should have never agreed to do the cath. Once he saw the lesion, it's kind of what we call it, the ocular stenotic reflex. You see something, you fix it. And you end up with a complication that it was unindicated. So you don't need pre-op testing for generally patients who are going to surgery. Who don't you send to surgery? You don't send anybody to surgery with unstable angina. You don't send anybody to surgery without thinking about it who has aortic stenosis. Hypertrophic cardiomyopathy is a high-risk patient for surgery. Patients with bad left ventricular function, but some of our associates would try to tell the anesthesiologist what kind of anesthesia to use. Anesthesiologist came back to us and said, "Hey, I do this all day long. Let me decide a type of anesthesia. You just tell me what the risk of surgery is." So that's that. Now, how would this thing be coded? Now, if you really want to have a lot of fun, maybe go out and get some medical marijuana and look at ICD-10s. I don't know what kind of person put ICD-10s together, but basically it's a comic book. Okay? It makes no sense at all. And it was supposed to be more specific. It is so unspecific that I can't even figure it out. Most of the things that we had with ICD-10, we couldn't even bill. So we had to go through the ICD-10, change our computer to find out what we could bill at. So this patient would have been diagnosed with, coded as 125.19, atherosclerotic heart disease of the native coronary artery with unspecified angina. R9.1, abnormal findings on diagnostic imaging of the heart and the coronary arteries. Pericardial effusion, not inflammatory. And acute post-procedure respiratory failure. I would rather code this as iatrogenesis fulminans. And I think you guys can know of cases this in your general practice of finding and tracing an incidentaloma and doing more procedures and the patient ends up with a complication because of it. So that's how that would have been coded. Okay, here's another typical case, and I'll summarize it for you. The always available and easy to obtain a troponin. So a healthy guy is playing tennis. It's a Friday afternoon. He has some chest discomfort. His friends are concerned about it. He's our age. So he calls a primary care physician, calls his buddies. They go, hey, you know, it's Friday afternoon. I'm out of here. Why don't you go to the ER? So shows up in the ER, and the first thing he says, I'm having chest pain. The receptionist calls back to the ER doc, says, hey, we got a guy here with chest pain. What's the first thing he says? Give him a nitro and order a troponin. So by the time he gets back into the suite, the chest discomfort is gone. Therefore, the chest discomfort is gone because he was given a nitroglycerin. So we order the troponin. The troponin is mildly elevated, upper limits are 0.12, it's 0.13. I go, oh my God, I can't send this guy home. So we'll order another troponin. The troponin is ordered now at 3 hours later. It is still mildly elevated. So it's 8 o'clock on Friday. The guy is not going home. He stays. They want to do a stress test in the morning. But the new person comes on, and you know the way you practice medicine. You're around for a week, then somebody else comes on. So now it's his turn around, and he looks at this guy with chest discomfort with two abnormal troponins. He doesn't want to do a regular stress test. He wants to do a cardiolite. There's no isotope available, so now he stays in the hospital. He's afraid to discharge him. Cardiolite's done on Monday. The guy goes 14 mets, discharge, no problem. Problem is, nobody clinically evaluated the patient. The first thing they did was order a troponin. Because the troponin is elevated, you have to have a heart problem. And that's not true. So you get a false sense of security when you have a normal troponin, but that doesn't rule out unstable angina. And you feel good when the troponin is normal, or when the troponin is abnormal, then obviously you've had a myocardial infarction. I've been woken up in the middle of the night at 3 o'clock in the morning by a nurse that says the troponin is elevated. I said, well, how's the patient? Well, he's sleeping. Okay, should we call the cath lab? No, we'll decide what to do in the morning. So don't focus on the troponin, don't focus on the lab test, focus on the patient. I would call this troponemia unnecessarius. That's how I would code it with ICD-10. Okay, look at this. Here are all the things that cause troponin to be elevated. It's a list that goes from hypertension to hypotension, to renal failure, to sepsis, to burns, to viral infections, to intracellular disease, to trauma, to your ICD going off, to cardioversion, to post-op, to whatever. So the troponin is a very sensitive test. If I can't make a diagnosis of acute myocardial infarction with a clinical history, an electrocardiogram, and a physical exam, I don't really need the troponin. And so this is a big chunk. This is a lake. It's the salt lake. It's not the little lake. It's not a puddle. It's not that hard to figure out who has a myocardial infarction and who doesn't. So when your troponin is elevated, you've opened up Pandora's box, and you got to start chasing it. Where do most of these tests come from? They come from the emergency room. Now, our emergency room colleagues, I feel sorry for them because I think my son's going to be an emergency room doctor, and they're up against this. So they have to chase tests. They do tests. And so they order a lot of troponins. I was talking to an ER guy last week, and I said, why are you ordering this troponins on these people? Because as the emergency room, college emergency room physicians tells us that's the first thing we should order. Order a troponin. You get them from pre-op cardiac clearance. And so why was this test ordered? Who ordered it? Was it ordered by the computer? Or was it ordered by the physician you just got sued? So when you're ordering these tests, figure out where they're coming from. This is the last thing I think I'm going to talk about, because now the computer reads the electrocardiograms. What's an abnormal electrocardiogram? A normal electrocardiogram is when the PR, the QRS, and the QT is normal, when the patient is in sinus rhythm with a rate between 60 and 100. Therefore, every other EKG that does not meet those criteria are abnormal. So I know at the Michigan State, you guys had 20 hours of electrocardiography. And you should understand and know the difference between the puddles and the lake and the big lake. So I get all kinds of consults, abnormal EKG. And now I'm seeing them from PAs and NPs, and there's nothing wrong with PAs and NPs. But a lot of these people are out there practicing on their own. And when they see something abnormal, they think they should get a cardiology consult. So sinus bradycardia, that's a puddle. Incomplete right bundle branch block, it means nothing. It's a puddle. Complete right bundle branch block, doesn't usually progress to do anything. Complete left bundle branch block, you may have left ventricular disease, it's worth an echo. You can order an echo. The echo is normal. You don't need a cardiologist. First degree AV block in somebody in their 80s with on digitalis, it's 0.24, point whatever. You might want to do a monitor to see if they're too bradycardic. It's more of a lake, but not really a puddle. Left ventricular hypertrophy, okay, that's a problem that should be looked at, probably with an echo to look to see if the patients, or you know, or they're hypertensive, or if they have aortic stenosis. Poor airway progression from V1 to V3, these are always read as anterior wall myocardial infarction. It's counterclockwise rotation of the heart, but the computer is going to read it as an anterior wall infarction. Nonspecific ST-T wave changes, hopefully they'll read them as nonspecific, but mostly they read them as ischemic. So you're stuck with this computerized red EKGs, which are trained to read something as abnormal because it's not totally normal. So when I'm teaching residents and fellows, I say, is the test abnormal because it's not totally normal, or is it abnormal because it meets criteria for being abnormal? That's a simple thing, but a big deal. Okay, so I think we're close to the time, yes. And so I want to just add with one, and I, you know, I talked, each one of us could have probably talked for an hour, but we're not going to. Oop, I already did it. I'm done. So the last case was, you know, a guy wants to go in. He wants to be sure his heart's okay. He does a stress test. He's got minimal ST segment changes. The cardiologist does a cardiolite. The cardiolite shows a little bit of ischemia in the anterior wall at 14 mets. He ends up with a heart catheterization. He comes home with a big bill saying, oh my God, I'm glad my heart is normal, despite the fact that he's got a hematoma in his groin and couldn't play golf for another 3 weeks. So the point is, evaluate the patient, then decide what tests should be done, decide what's the difference between a puddle, a lake, and a big lake.